Yo, 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 what's good, y'all? Welcome back to The Emergency Room Sucks. I am your host, Bethany D. And of course, we got Isaac on the mic. Isaac, where you at?
Hello, everybody. It's Isaac Rodriguez, and I'm happy to be here today.
Hey, Isaac. So today we have something really, really special for you guys. Really special. A guest who is very special to me and his dear, beautiful, very equally dedicated, decorated wife. I'm so humbled and honored to introduce these guests, and I'm so excited that they agreed to be on the podcast. Everyone, please get ready to be schooled by the GOAT in the trauma business, Dr. Reginald Jones and his wife, Miss Lisa Jones. Dr. Lisa Jones.
I hope that you don't say the GOAT next week when we get somebody else on.
He is the GOAT. I tell him that all the time.
He's not going to say anything, but I want to hear what he says when I let him know you introduced Reggie as the GOAT.
Go. What do you think?
It's all good.
See?
I'm happy and humbled to be on. Thank you for inviting me.
Doctors, thank you so much. I cannot thank you enough for being here. So let's start with you, Dr. Reginald Jones. Tell the people who you are and what you do.
So, like I said, I'm a trauma surgeon, acute care surgeon. I hail from LA. I was born in South Central. And I spent my career after med school here, did residency at MLK, and met my lovely wife, gosh, what, 30 plus years ago. We've been married going on 32 years. And she's been in the struggle with me. I'm a surgeon, and we have two wonderful kids.
Nice. And then they went on to, what, UCLA? Or where did they go?
So my daughter went to UCLA, graduated in 2017.
Hey.
And my son is at Brown.
Nice, nice. And when is he supposed to graduate?
Hopefully, if everything goes well, 2024.
Nice. Very good. Good job. Dr. Lisa Jones?
Yes.
Tell the people who you are.
So I'm, as she said, Dr. Lisa Jones. I do not have a medical degree. What I have is a doctorate in psychology. And what I'm currently doing is working as a school counselor at a Catholic school in Huntington Beach. And I've been doing many different things over the years. I've gotten used to always wanting to be there for children, and so that's my biggest accomplishment. It's just I love being with the kids, making sure that their mental health is okay during the school time, especially during this pandemic.
Oh yeah,
that's what I've been working on, and we always laugh. I'm also Dr. Reggie Jones is a personal therapist. Seems like at home.
30 plus years of free therapy.
Well, nice. Anybody who's done trauma, anybody who's in ER, we all wish we had a personal therapist at home. He is fortunate. He is fortunate. He is one of the few.
We'll talk to that. We'll talk about that later.
All right. So one of the reasons why I'm really glad to have you guys on is because, first and foremost, people of color don't see too many people of color who have made it, who are educated, who are responsible, and who just actually make a difference in the world. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on. I was reading an article. It was an article written by a guy named Enrique Rivero. He's one of the senior media relations officers over at the UCLA Health Science Department. He posted some content on his vlog. It was a study about the historical trends of Black physicians and their representation in America over the last 118 years. So he went back all the way to 1900, and he found that in 1900, 1.3% of the sample population that they tested were Black physicians. And then in 2018, that percentage only raised by a little bit to be 5.4% of the same sample population. So, you know, all those times I would kind of mess with you guys in the trauma room, like, oh, why are you being so stank? Stop yelling at me, blah, 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 blah. Now I get it, because you guys are really an elite part of the population. And like, my hats go off to you. So I think people should really, really praise you for that.
Well, thank you. It all that is true. And it's tough. And you are, look out into the crowd, especially I just recently came home from a trauma conference. And when you look out into the crowd and you see maybe one, two, or maybe five other minorities, and out of those, like, five or maybe 10, you know half of them, because we are such a small group, and it is difficult. And, you know, so that's why we need to, that's why this is important, to elevate, raise awareness, and, you know, give that next generation the ability to say, if I can do it, they can definitely do it. And that's what I do when I go back to my high school, and elementary school, and all that other stuff. I try to tell them, hey, you know what, if I can do it, you can do it. Don't be discouraged. And Lord knows I've had plenty of people try to discourage me. And, you know, you just got to stay positive, keep the ship a sail, and get good people around you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I have to tell everybody how I came to know Dr. Jones in such a way. One day we were doing a trauma, and this was a really busy night. Now, mind you, when we call a trauma in the hospital, the surgeons are usually sleeping or doing something else, and they get pulled away from what they're doing to respond to this trauma. Long story short, if you call a trauma and, you know, the surgeon really doesn't believe it's worthy, they get upset, they're tired, or whatever. Long story short, we were working on a patient that I think Dr. Jones was suturing or something like that. And I made a comment in which, to this day, I forget what I said, but he stopped what he was doing and he looked right at me and he said, you know, I've been doing this for 17 years and you don't know what you're talking about. You're talking to a G. And I said, oh, I understood. I'm talking to a G. And we've been cool ever since.
That typifies exactly how I tell people it's been 25 years. That sounds definitely like me and my wife laughing, because she knows that is definitely, my. So I do say things like that.
I was very humbled, because I was the one who was the trauma nurse that always went in the trauma room. And it's like, I'm the trauma nurse, you guys listen to me. Well, this was the first time I had ever worked with Dr. Jones. I had worked with other surgeons before. And so I guess whatever I said, he was just tired. He just wasn't feeling it. And he shot me down. I was like, dang.
It wasn't, no. No,
you educated her.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I got schooled by the goat.
No, let's call it an education, Matrix style.
That's right. That's right.
Listen, I wasn't trying to draw the battle lines. I was just, you know, making. I was a G.
Oh, jeez.
I'm from the hood, and sometimes it gets a little edgy.
Mm-hmm.
What is it that grabbed your attention? Because you could have. I mean, when somebody goes into surgery, I mean, the field is vast. There's all kinds of stuff you could have done. But one of the least, I don't want to say it's the least rewarding, but it is, I would say, some people have called it grunt work compared to plastic surgery or other specialties. You're putting yourself in a world that many people don't want to touch. What attracted you to trauma and general surgery?
I think general surgery and trauma is very rewarding. I think that first of all, surgery in general. So this is what I tell the kids and everything. They're like, hey, why didn't you, do internal medicine or go in, or why did you pick surgery? And I said, surgery picked me, number one. I'm a perfectionist. So I like to make sure I do it right the first time. Number two, I don't have the temperament to follow a patient like 10 years or 5 years as their diabetes and their hypertension kind of, you know, deals with them as they go through their lives. I saw my parents go through that. And so I chose surgery for the immediate gratification. Mm-hmm. So surgery has the gratification. The other thing was, a trauma patient, and I have had friends that were trauma patients. And trauma, we have a saying in trauma, that people are young and they seal and they heal. And so that's one of our little, you know, hey, they're young and they seal and they heal and they go home and they live their life, put them back together. And so there's a certain amount of immediate gratification with trauma. So, you know, you kind of pick your poison. I didn't like pediatric surgery because you got two sets of patients. You got the patient, you got the baby, the kid, and you got the parents. I didn't like that.
Yeah.
Classic was highly technical and all that kind of stuff. And although it sounds sexy, that wasn't for me.
Yeah.
Plastics, just at its core, you have an individual, if you do aesthetics or whatever, that's not happy with themselves, and the question is, are you ever going to make them happy? Or you have something that really, really, something bad happened to somebody, and you have to put them back together, and you have to deal with that. That's a serious new normal as opposed to the new normal that we deal with trauma. So that's why I picked it. It sort of picked me.
That's what's up. I actually feel that. I feel the same way. Like, I don't think that anything outside of trauma was fulfilling to me. That's why I felt like once I left St. Francis, I was so unhappy because not only did I leave my family, but I left everything that I learned. Like, I was born and raised with you guys as a nurse. And so you guys taught me like literally everything that I know from, you know, Dr. Pryor, Dr. Shepherd, Dr. Jimenez, you guys taught me so much. So that was the hard part for me.
Yeah, all those individuals are icons. And, you know, and again, with trauma, you get a little bit of everything. You open the chest, you get into the abdomen, you fix vessels and all that without the intricateness of the subspecialist you have to come in. You know, without those little intricacies, you do a little bit of everything. I like that.
Yeah.
Lisa, when you met Reggie, was he just as the way he is now, or was he more of an introvert?
Oh, he was an introvert, definitely. I was the outgoing one, and he was the introvert. And my mom used to say, watch out for those quiet ones. But I would say that he's the type of person that, you know, he starts off being introverted, but once you get to know him, you're like, okay, what just happened? You need to tone that down.
Yes.
He's like, right for the party, and it's like, what happened?
Yes.
It's a lot of, here's what I noticed working with you, Reggie. Early on, you came more or less to St. Francis around the time I did. You got there in 2002?
Yes.
And I was telling you, the group, I think the trauma services had been open, 10 years at that time? It was still fairly new at St. Francis, is that correct?
Correct. It was 96, 97 when it opened.
So it was about 5 years old. It was still fairly new.
Mm-hmm.
A doctor by the name of Solomon Little mentioned you to me. When you came into that hospital and you came into that department, what were the goals? What was it you were looking for? One thing we came up, here's something, and the reason I'm bringing all this up, I realized that a lot of people went in there with an agenda, and they all wanted it to be done a certain way, yet when you went in there, there were times where you just took control of the room, and you had to guide everybody a certain way. You had to play doctor, you had to play leader, you had to play general, you had to play therapist, all of that within about, 4 minutes? What is it you were trying to accomplish when you got there? What is it that surprised you about St. Francis? Were you ever able to achieve any of those goals?
My goal, number one, was just to get a job. That was my goal. St. Francis opened up an opportunity for me when I had a personal crisis. St. Francis kind of opened up that opportunity for me to work. I needed to work. And, I had no agenda. My whole focus was to be the best physician I could be and the best surgeon I could be.
Nice.
I had no preconceived agenda or anything like that. I just wanted to focus on the people. Now, St. Francis was dear to my heart because it reminded me of the community that I hail from. Again, I'm from South Central, 68th in Vermont. anybody from South Central. And so it reminded me of the community, the underserved community that I was from. And there were times when my friends and family went to little bitty hospitals and didn't have good care. I wanted to make sure that the people that I served had good care, the best care I can give them.
So that's what's up.
That was it.
And that's one of the reasons why we're doing this podcast, is so we get that message out there.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's very important, that healthcare should be equal across the board, whether you're at St. Francis, Cedars, Brigham's, you know what I mean? Wherever you are, healthcare should be equal across the board.
What is it you saw at St. Francis that surprised you initially?
That's a good question. What did I saw people that were sort of, I saw a set of older surgeons when I first came out. I was the new guy, the young guy. And it moved a little bit slower than I was used to. So I didn't have a lot of energy. Now, as my mother said, you know, when we moved into our neighborhood, we were the young people. Now we the old ladies, you know what I mean? And so now as I transition to being the old guy, the young guys are like, hey, man, we're going a little slow, you know. But that's what I saw. I saw a group of older surgeons that needed an infusion of youth, and I was initially that infusion. Actually, I had to hold me back a little bit. Hey, you know, you got to slow down.
Slow down?
I never
knew you had to slow down. Becky, did you remember him having to slow down?
I missed the question, sorry.
I said, I don't remember you having him slow down. I was going to ask Anthony, do you remember him slowing down?
No way.
No, I hit the ground when I hit in 2002. I hit the ground running. I wanted to be involved in everything. I wanted to be involved with gang prevention. When I met Paul Carrillo, I set up this meeting with Paul and brother and the sheriff's department, the LA County Sheriff's Department. When Leroy Baca, and he was still the sheriff back then, and we all had this meeting about gang prevention and how Paul has gone on and created this wonderful program. And then the tattoo removal that I was trying to work with Mike Steffens, and then I ended up working with another ER, Alex Kaplan, and all this kind of stuff. And I wanted to be involved in everything. St. Patrick was a wonderful thing because, you know, you got to remember. So Bethany and I, we bonded. She remembers how I stepped to her like, hey, you know, I'm a G. But pondered on the fact that I went to St. Bernard's and Bethany went to St. Mary's.
Right.
And St. Francis being a Catholic hospital at the time. And, you know, that was all, it was like coming home. Because I pray, I'm a religious individual. And working at a Catholic hospital made my mother proud. And all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. That's amazing.
And doing all of this when you just had a kid, you know, a young kid, and I decided that that's when I was going to start working on my degree of getting a psychology degree, and that's when I got into the master's program.
Nice. And what school did you attend, Dr.?
For my master's, I attended University of Los Angeles.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Antioch University, Los Angeles.
Okay.
That was my master's program, and then for my doctorate, Alliance International University.
California
Schools. Well, yeah, it's better known as California
Schools of
Professional Psychology.
Nice. Nice.
Reggie introduced me to Lisa about 15 years ago. Yep. And she's the first actual therapist I ever dealt with.
Really?
It was the beginning of me looking for it. Here's the thing that surprised me about myself in hindsight. I went into it thinking I went into it with my eyes open, being aware of it, left it wondering what the hell is wrong with you, Isaac.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an education. One, because I asked myself, what is it I'm doing? Why is it I'm doing what I'm doing? How is it affecting me? I just ignored those questions for a while. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't to her. It was something she was sincere about. I know we touched on certain subjects when I was with her. That surprised even me. Right now you're working with kids, Lisa?
Yes, yes. That's where it seems like I've landed right here now. I don't know if I'm going to, you know, that's always going to be my my thing, but it seems like every job that I've had always lands me back to working with children and families. And I think a lot of it is the same thing of just, you know, when you're growing up, I was an only child growing up, adopted, and, you know, you just have this sense of family and wanting to be there for other children. So I actually spent 10 years working as a family preservation, all about, you know, preserving the family and trying to keep the families together for those who were at risk of being taken home. Wow. So that really got that feeling of I want to do more, and I wanted to do, you know, it was kind of like, okay, I'm working with them as far as keeping them in the home. But a lot of our, you know, working in South Central, a lot of the our families were being placed in foster homes. And it's like, how can we keep the family together? Many times it was just, you know, the parents needed to follow whatever the court orders were. There might be something else, some, you know, family issues that are going on. And that's the part where I started thinking, you know, sometimes these families just need some counseling too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's where my passion started going into that direction. So through my studies and internships and things at agencies, but it always lands me back to the kids. I'm, you know, trying to work with children and their families to, you know, prevent things that could happen in the future.
That's beautiful. There's not enough protected kids out here. And we see it every day in the ER. It's just so crazy.
Greg, one time you saw me, you may not remember this conversation, but one time I was judging a gangster who had, I don't know if he'd been shot. Something happened to him. He was a trauma. And you told me that I should take a step back and understand what we're doing. It's not simply going in and like hope. I think you mocked treat them and street them. Like you said, it's frontline. We are the first ones to see them, but it's our job to take care of them.
Sure.
Not just treat them and street them.
Correct.
Now, the reason I bring that up is because it was something that made me realize I had to do a bit more as far as not taking it personally, but being more appropriate with the patients.
Mm-hmm.
Giving them a bit more respect. Where did that come from? Because some people can get burned out, Reggie. Some people can. And they will take the approach of you treat them and you treat them, and that's it.
You know. Right. So, you have to understand, it goes back to my roots. And growing up, you know, we all make judgments. You know, I was judged as a kid, bullied the whole nine yards. That's a whole nother Oprah.
Okay.
But what I have always felt passionate about is treating everybody equally, justly. And when a trauma patient comes in, what I try not to do for me and the team is try not to judge. You know, if you may have tattoos, you may be a wonderful person. You just can't judge a book by its cover.
That's right.
And you got to understand that this person who was injured may not survive it. You may be the last person they see. You may be the last voice they hear. And I think that everybody deserves a little compassion. I remember that. I remember that. I remember pulling your life. And I've done it to other people. Because I think that we have to, you know, when a trauma patient comes in, not judging them. They didn't pick me, I didn't pick them, but at least I can give them the humanity,
mm-hmm.
and give them my humility as a human being and caring. Because, you know, you start to tell somebody, hey, you know what, you got shot, I take you to surgery, they don't know me, they're looking at me like, what? And, you know, not looking at them like, hey, you know, you're another gangster, whatever. Yeah, that's something I always, even to this day, I still do kind of, if I see that or something like that, I try to tell people, hey, you know what, maybe take a step back, don't judge, you know, and all that kind of stuff. I think that everybody, because like I said, I'm from the hood, and, you know, people are like, oh, you know, you're from the hood, you don't deserve this or that or the other thing. I mean, come on. So that was it. I've actually done that before. You know, quite a few times. So,
and it's one thing that he did that would always amaze me. And we have to take a break after this, and we're going to transition into something else. But one of the things, Dr. Jones, that you did, and I mean, I still talk about this, is that you commanded your trauma room. And when you had a trauma patient that came in, shot, judged, or, you know, just was treated inhumanely by maybe police or whatever, you would close that curtain in their face, kick them out your trauma room. They would be all in your grill, and you're like, no, this is my room. Get out. And that's one thing that I always speak when I speak about you.
Still do that, by the way.
Well, we're going to take a little break here, but when we come back, let's kind of just transition into what it was like for you, I guess, physically and mentally, trying to become a physician with all these odds against you. We'll be right back, guys. All right, guys, we are back. And for those of you who are just now checking in, we have a fabulous trauma surgeon and his lovely wife, Dr. Reginald Jones and Dr. Lisa Jones. So one of the questions I have for you guys is, you know, just like you said earlier, you know, we grew up in the hood. We grew up in a town that, you know, we didn't have like freaking Porsches and Mercedes driving to school. Our parents actually worked and struggled to send us to private schools. So this question is for both of you.
I grew up in a nice area.
Oh, shut up. What does it take physically and mentally to become a doctor when all the odds are against you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So for me, it was real tough. And like you did, definitely have to tell you, you gave me a chill up and down my face, my neck, because my parents did work really hard to send me to St. Bernard's, you know, to private school and all that kind of stuff. And my neighborhood was rough, two drug dealers, and my next door neighbor was a lady of the night and all that kind of stuff. So I had huge struggles, and I grew up on the Crips, you know, the rolling 60s on 68th Street and all that kind of stuff. So that was tough. The first thing was high school. I had to get over that hurdle because my counselors, and Lisa knows the story, and she'll probably be like, no, don't say that. But my counselor wasn't supportive. Sister Dolores, again, that's another whole Oprah. She's probably gone. I'm sure she's gone now. She was old then.
Oh, damn.
But despite her, and not despite it, but despite her lack of encouragement, I had to find it within myself. And it took a lot mentally and physically. It took a lot. And I would say that, number one, I had, at the time when I was coming up, a steely-eyed focus. I said, you know what? No one's going to, it was a point in my life, I said, no one's going to stop me from being a doctor. So, and at first, I tried to screw it up. I have a praying mom. My mom says no Venus to this day about her oldest son.
Uh-oh.
And I held tight to the fact that I could do this. And I did. I got through it. I was a non-traditional medical student, not in age. I was a traditional medical student in age, but I was a little bit older, and I was married. I was married through the time med school. So I had that stability. And the mental, Lisa was the mental stability factor in med school. And people are running around, stressed out. I mean, I was running around stressed out, believe you me, because I had a wife and I had to support her and all that kind of stuff. And I was on the East Coast and dealing with all the stuff over on the East Coast. And first time away from home for the both of us. She had just graduated from UCLA. A year before we got married, and so that was rough, you know. But she was my stabilizing factor, so she helped me with the mental part. And before she was a therapist, official therapist, physically, it's rough. You're staying up, you're going to school and all that. So now that's med school. And so then I decided, well, I always wanted to come back home. That was the whole thing. You know, I saw Martin Luther King Hospital being built in 72. Kenneth Hoffman cutting the ribbon and all that. And we had our hospital. And look how the Alpha and the Omega, the full circle, ended up working there and doing residency there and things like that.
Yes.
And at first it was like, oh my God, how can I survive this? And my friends that I have now are the individuals that I trained with and all that. And I said, well, I got to give, my mother was proud. She's like, oh yeah, you're coming back. You're going to be at MLK. You're going to give back to the people. And again, it goes back to the notion that everybody deserves good care no matter where you are. Man, you have Cedars and all that. And, you know, but it was rough. There were times when, and this was before, so there's the Libby Zion law where residents have residency protected hours and all this kind of stuff. And that wasn't around necessarily when I was coming through. I worked 2 and 3 days and I'd come home half dead after working like a day and a half. And I'd get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to be at the hospital at 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was taxing. And I'm going to share something with you guys and whoever out there in the land. So every year as a resident, we got 1 month vacation. Lisa's sitting right here and she's gonna be a test. I know she knows what I'm gonna say. So I planned on a 1 month straight. So the first 2 weeks is when we would go and do something. We'd go to San Diego. I had my daughter, my baby girl, she was an infant. And I said, you know what? I need 2 weeks on the back end to get ready, to get mentally ready and physically prepared to enter back into residency, right? So the third week, I'd get sick. I'd, oh, no, I got to go face the dome. I got to go back into it. And the last week, Lisa's going to tell you, I would sit there, and for some reason, I'd watch Glory every day. I had to watch the movie Glory to get me angry. Like, oh, I got to get back into the struggle.
Oh, my God.
I watched Glory every day. I watched Glory for 1 week straight before going back. I had to rev back up. I had to, like, okay, I'm in the struggle. It's Civil War. I got to get back in it.
Oh, oh my gosh. That's dedication right there.
I watched Glory, like, the last week of my vacation, I watched Glory, like, every day.
That is. So my look, I'm going to tell you guys that my history teacher in high school made us watch Glory. And he actually focused on a scene that a lot of people now this is back in 1990. So Glory had only been out, 2 years?
Yeah, something like that.
What it is today. A lot of people go back on it. They remember how Denzel Washington got his first Oscar and the scene that gave him his Oscar.
Correct.
But he asked us, look at what he's doing. Why is he crying? What's the look? He made us see that scene more than once. And he wanted us to understand American history. Cyril Sepulveda. I'll never forget that, man. I'm curious. Did you see it? When you were watching and getting angry, were you paying attention to the details? Because I remember when I saw it as a kid, I was thinking, what the hell is wrong with my teacher?
So, of course. So, listen, you know how I am with it. And I watched it for a week straight, the last week before my month vacation. And so, yeah, I still know every intricacy. And so, of course, when Denzel, that tear that fell, that was always great. But it's the scene. So, here's the thing. It was about a bunch of African-American or whatever the vernacular back then, soldiers going against the odds. They were the black sheep, if you will, and they weren't getting paid, and they were struggling, and they had to go and now remember, Colonel Shaw volunteered them for Fort Wagner after they had already fought a war. And one of the main things that he said, if this man should fall, who's going to pick up the flag? And then and they said, I will. And that was the scene that made all the difference to me. I watched it because that's the last scene. And that's the thing. You got to understand. King, and this is going to be part of my own podcast, which we'll talk about at the end, about the history of minority surgeons in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
You got to understand. King was built out of tragedy. And it's not the tragedy of August 11, 1965, the Watts riot. It was something that happened after that. There was a guy named Leonard Duckweiler that was driving his wife, and she was pregnant, to the hospital. He got stopped by the police. And we're not going to get into that or intricate, but he ended up getting killed by the LAPD.
And
we decided that we needed our own hospital. And so, remember, a black man had to fall. And who's going to pick up the flag for that black man? And I felt like that was me every time I went to work at King. But I had to stand up for Leonard Duckweiler and all the other individuals and stand on their shoulders and give the best care I could.
That's right. That's right. Hey. That's awesome.
Reggie, I mean, I appreciate that approach emotionally. That's a heavy burden to take upon yourself. It wasn't given to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you chose.
Mm-hmm.
No, listen, let me tell you something. This is what I tell the kids. No one's going to give you a thing in this world. This mm-hmm. world is janky. It is air.
Yes.
It's unreasonable. And, you know, Denzel said that, at your highest moment, how the devil will take it from you. Well, at your lowest moment, the devil's going to step on you, and the good people will step on you.
That's right.
You know what I mean? So if you want it, if you want medicine or whatever you want in life, you got to take it.
Yes.
You got to take it. It's not going to be given to you. You got to go out there and take it. And that's why I try to tell my kids, my children, God bless them, they're suburbanites. I'm not going to talk about my kids, but they're suburbanites because Lisa and I did that heavy lifting.
Mm-hmm.
We got through it. And you have to take it. You just got to take it.
Yes.
No one's going to give it. No one's going to hand it to you. My parents didn't hand it to me. They were like, good luck. I love them. Daddy's gone. But you have to take it. And so, yeah, no one's going to give it to you. You got to take it. You got to want it more than anything. You got to take it. And once you get it, you got to defend it.
That's right.
Every single day, because they're going to look at you and, okay, and you got to defend it. I have to defend this MD and my surgical abilities every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And like all of us, you have to defend your RN every single day. Every single day of your life, you got to defend it.
But then we get labeled like, oh, she's a bitch, or, she talks back or she's insubordinate. And it's not that. It's just, like you said, you have to defend what you work for. And for the longest time, I had like this tension with Dr. Shepherd because I felt that, he was overbearing or arrogant. And we've spoken about this, but really he was teaching me. And one day I had attended a advanced trauma class that he was teaching, and he got on that stage and I just was captivated. I was captivated. And you guys embodied that character every single time we work together. I am defending my license. I'm defending what I work for. I'm defending my background. I'm standing up for what I believe in. And it was amazing to see.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for that. And, Shepherd is a wonderful person and a smart man, a great surgeon. He has this kind of zen about him. And it's true. It's hard. It's hard. I go back to another movie. I was just teasing the other day. I was talking to the medical students at California Hospital. And I was tired and I was supposed to call and I was talking about a bad case that I had. And I told them, I said, you ever see the movie 300? They're like, 300, is that about the Greeks? And that, I'm like, yeah. But it's when Spartan, the little kid Spartan, when he was in the cave and he had to face the wolf, and he had to pick up the spear, and then it goes into that narrative about how the spear was heavy. And he had to balance it, and he had to take aim, and he had to defend himself. And that's what we go through. For me, the scalpel is heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to balance it, and I have to calm myself, and I have to save that life. Just if I was at Cedars, or if I was at Harvard, or if I was just at St. Francis or California Hospital, because the scalpel is the great, is the thing that balances us all. It's the great equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know what I mean? And it doesn't matter who's, you know, holding it. As long as you have the technical skill to do it, it's the great equalizer. And it's hard, and it is heavy, and the scalpel is heavy. And I saw the medical students, yeah, anybody want to go into surgery, yeah, you have to understand it's rough, whatever you do in your life.
Yeah, yeah. Dr. Lisa, I know that you, you said that you were actually starting school when he was finishing school, and you were a mom and all of that. So I know you had a heavy burden as well, mentally, physically, spiritually.
Yes, absolutely. It was tough because, you know, you're trying to struggle as a working mom. And then even if it's working on your degree, because I, you know, I had the benefit of having my husband now, you know, taking his turn to be out there and struggle to make the bills and things like that. And I had the opportunity to, you know, not many have the opportunity to work on my education, you know, furthering my education. But it was still a little tough when, you know, you have a baby at home and still needing to do that. And at the same time, you know, you've got to be there for your husband. So it was a lot. It was a lot. The fact that we're so, the thing about our marriage is that we're so willing to be there for each other, mm-hmm. that it really just balances all out. You know,
yes.
It's like a moment, he'll have his moment. We can't be in the same moment at the same time.
Right.
It's kind of, you know, so we've always worked on that. And I'm just one where I've been the type of person where I get it. I was there, like he said. You know, we knew each other 5 years before we got married.
Nice.
I knew that he wanted to become a doctor. I also wanted to become a doctor. So, you know, we looked at all of that. And there was a plan. When you go to med school, we're not having children. Because, for one, we're way out here in the East Coast by ourselves. And that there's just, I'd rather you finish med school before we even think about that. So when we came back here to West Coast, then of course we're like, hey, now here's an opportunity, let's go ahead and further our family, grow our family. But then there, you know, there's always a time that, and that's what took me a long time to get to the point where I was getting what I wanted, was because family for me was coming first.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then when it was able to balance out where it's like, okay, you finished residency, you have the career now at St. Francis. Now I want to go back and further my education.
That's right.
So, like I said, the one thing that I always understood with this process is when you're married to a trauma surgeon, he is going to be working a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was secure with that.
Mm-hmm.
I was secure. I knew, because when he's home, he's home. I didn't have to worry about, oh, you know, after he gets home, then now where is he going?
Mm-hmm.
No, when he's home, he's home. And he's very family oriented. So that helps, you know, for me as well.
That's a great dynamic.
I think that's, you know, because I would hear things of folks who, you know, I don't like being married to a trauma doctor or a doctor. You know, they're always gone. They're always busy. They're always working. Well, for me, that's normal. I'm used to it. I knew what we were setting up for, and that was the plan. Just like, you know, when it was time for me to have to do what I needed to do, he had to know the same thing, and we all were able to come back together.
That's what's up.
And she had a great scholarship program, by the way.
Yes, the Reggie Jones Scholarship.
That's okay. That's the king lifting up his queen and vice versa, right?
Oh. I was there working while he was in med school.
That's all right. And you know, we don't see that, like I said, people of color. You turn on Instagram and everybody's twerking. Or, you know, Will Smith is walking on stage. And I don't want to transition into Will Smith. I really don't. But I have to say this. How he going to act a whole fool, walk up there and slap that man after years ago saying the Oscars was so white? Now you get up there and act like a whole N-I blank blank A.
Right. Yeah,
you know, and it's like, we don't need to see that.
Right, that was tough, yeah. So, yeah, you're right. We'll just say, leave it like that. I agree with you. Yeah,
I don't want to bring all of that up.
Let's not bring it up. I will transition to something else. I will happily not make that the subject of this conversation.
Please, yeah, no, sorry.
You've seen hospital care transition from one way of doing things to another. Trauma services, have they suffered because of it? Have they gotten better support? Are the changes all good, or is it all bad?
From this vantage point, things they changed. And being on the older side of things, and like I said, these younger people coming up, the paradigms are changing. It looks bad to me. Looking back, I think that doctors in general have relinquished a lot of the administrative roles in hospitals. And in so doing, we have lost a lot of our political voices in the hospital and things like that. And we've been relegated to being sort of the handmaidens of administration, if I can say that.
Right.
And I think that somehow it has to shift back. We're the ones, you know, there wouldn't be a church without the people.
Mm-hmm.
We have all that kind of stuff. And there wouldn't be a hospital without the doctors. I think that we need to find our voice again and make ourselves important again to the hospital. And I think that we've lost a lot of ground over time. The individuals that are coming out now don't want to have private practices and stuff like that. And I think it lends itself to what I see is like itinerancy. And so, you know, like I have an old saying, I'm an old guy, you know, you cut, you keep. I like to follow the patient, make sure they're good, see them in my office, call me if there's any problems. And I think that is, that's changing over time.
Mm-hmm.
I may be right, but I see that with the new paradigms that are coming around. And so I don't think it's all for the good. And I, like I said, I may be an older guy looking back on his 25-year career. I don't know.
No, that's why I left the bedside, because I didn't like the changes that were being made. And once I left St. Francis, I just saw a really big difference in the way the care was distributed. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think it is something that needs to be brought up. And the reason I brought that question up is because you're not the first to tell me that.
Mm-hmm.
Hear a lot of doctors say that they don't see the same enthusiasm from the young generation coming to be doctors and falling, or when they're done with medical school and they become doctors and they see what they're dealing with, it discourages them.
Correct.
That as it was before. Because now you're dealing with, I guess, corporate America in a way that you never had to deal with them before.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, it's a legitimate question. I don't know if the doctor's voice should be eliminated. I don't think companies should have the final word.
I think we're on the front lines taking care of the patients. And even though medicine has a business aspect and ultimately is a business, and a lot of my colleagues are like, oh, you know, I'm going to go back to school and get that MBA. Remember, I came to St. Francis because I think that every patient deserves equal care and all this kind of stuff. And that's hard. Mm-hmm. That's a hard thing to do. And so I think that there is a great disparity. And Lisa was like, when you were talking, Isaac, Lisa was saying, you know, that's the reason why my kids don't want to go into medicine. You know, my daughter said 5 minutes at UCLA, she went to UCLA, like, come on. And 5 minutes, she said, Dad, nope, you don't want it. I'll let you keep doing it. And I love you, but I don't want it.
Yeah.
My son, he got to his school, and he looked around, he goes, Dad, he called me, he goes, Dad, you know what? Because he wanted to be, he said, I want to be an ophthalmologist because the eye don't bleed. I know y'all, I've said that before. You don't want the blood and guts because he got tired of the stories, me coming home all bloody and, you know, sleeping on the couch and all that. But then he said he got there, he said, Dad, you know, I saw kids that were doing it because their parents were doing it. I didn't want to be that kid. He said, I saw kids that were doing it because they had no idea what they were getting into. And I don't want to be that kid.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, forget about it.
I heard that, little dude. That's why I chose nursing. I was like, remember I used to always say to you, that's why my bad say RN and yours say MD.
You did say that.
I did not want that burden.
There's a personal part of being a doctor that even nurses and those who help in the emergency room or trauma services don't always get to see. I think there are times where you get to see more of the end of a story with these patients, Reggie. You see more of them than we ever do. We get there at the beginning. We get there halfway. We may meet them halfway or a quarter of the way to the OR. We never really see what happens afterwards. Many times they go in and they do get to see you.
Right.
How many times do those patients ever tell you, you know what, major impact, thank you, or you felt there was a difference?
Oh my God.
You made a difference.
So there have been a few. And I shared one recently. So I had a patient. It wasn't a trauma patient, but it was a gentleman who was close to my age. He was in his 50s. And he had appendicitis. And if you look at the data about appendicitis and an individual who gets appendicitis in their 50s and all that kind of stuff, you have to worry about them having colon cancer. So I told him, I said, hey, you know what? If you hadn't had a colonoscopy, I'm going to take out your appendix, and hopefully it's okay. But if you hadn't had a colonoscopy, you know, you need a colonoscopy. He came to see me, and I called a friend of mine, and I referred him, and he got his colon. He ended up having something that was taken care of at the colonoscopy, and he sent me a nice little thing. He sent me a picture of himself, and he wrote on the back a very nice quote about one of the great samurais, Musashi, and he thanked me for giving him extra time because that encouraged him to work himself up. There have been a few trauma patients, you know, and trauma is an interesting thing. And that's why I enjoyed it, because I enjoyed kind of putting people back together.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got to understand this, and that's why I tell people about trauma surgery and surgery in general. Remember, you know, I put you back together on the inside. You don't know what your insides look like. I do when I operate on you. And I put things back together, reroute things and all that kind of stuff. And Lisa and I talk about this all the time. I have to help people adjust and accept the new normal. And I have to guide them through that, hold their hand and help them figure it out because they're different. And if you don't do that effectively, if you don't do that well, people get confused, they get frustrated, pissed off because, hey, guess what? I took out a third of your intestine. Or I took out half your colon. Or I did this, I did that. But what I had to do to save your life, and you have to guide them through that. And it was always rewarding to kind of complete the circle. And, you know, see them in the office and, hey, call me if you have any problems and follow up with them. And I've had some nice notes and little things like that over the years. So.
That is amazing. We are going to take a small little break right now. And when we come back, we're going to start winding down and just kind of see, you know, the aftermath of, you know, everything that the doctors have gone through and where they're going in the future. We'll be right back. All right, guys, we are back and we are still having a great conversation with two of my favorite doctors, Dr. Jones and Dr. Jones. All right. So, Dr. Lisa, you were about to explain how, what did you ask Isaac? I forgot.
I asked how it is that you said my two favorite Dr. Joneses. You just said Lisa.
She's still my favorite Dr. Jones.
I got to say that to her. I got good quality time with her. How did she become your favorite?
You are such a hater, bro.
But I know my husband. He has probably talked about me a lot.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
So I was going to ask you, Lisa, how has COVID affected the children in school?
Yeah, so when the pandemic hit in 2020, you know, I had just started at this particular school that February. So, you know, I'm all excited and everything. And then I'm sure enough, a month later, it's like we're all going to Zoom. So I was fortunate enough to still be able to see some of my students where the family members wanted me to still keep in touch with them through virtual. So I would have Zoom meetings at home and, you know, for the rest of that school year. So we were able to do that. Then our principal was awesome. She worked very hard, very diligent with the Archdiocese of Orange and got the school to, you know, through the governor and everything, was able to open the school back up where the kids could come in person. And not very many schools were able to do that when the fall of 2020 came about. So people had an option where they could either still, if they weren't comfortable bringing their students back, they could opt for to still stay at home and be virtual. I did notice that even though I would see some of the students like that still virtually, it was a struggle because they wanted to be back in the classroom. They missed their friends.
Mm-hmm.
Very hard for them to do Zoom sessions. Very hard for them to do schooling through virtual. Their mental health was declining, I could tell. And a lot of times the family members were also seeing it. Then, of course, when we get back to school, everything was, well, you had to stay 6 feet apart. You couldn't play on the playground. And you try and tell that to, like, kindergartners and even eighth graders that they could not be that close to their classmates. It was hard. It was definitely a struggle. And that mental health, I could just keep seeing it coming and coming. It was declining, you know, faster than anything.
Mm.
I was seeing a lot of students at that point. Now it's interesting that since we're completely back in person at the school, there are no virtual classes. Now what's interesting is that some students seem to have forgotten how to hang out with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's been a lot of people where there's a lot of peer issues, still some family issues happening. There's a lot of bullying that's going on. So it's kind of like, well, what's happened? That 1 year, everybody just sort of seemed like they've lost their minds in that one year. And so trying to get back into a proper mental headspace, it's been a struggle.
Mm.
One of the issues I came across actually were, it was a family member of mine, and she had a hard time adjusting. She was expecting a lot. She's very young. And she was expecting a lot of 2020 when it hit. But I think the shock of being removed from people, something she had a hard time getting over with. Did you have to deal with that with your kids? Were they okay? If you don't have to answer. I'm curious to know if it affected the home, because you have two highly intelligent people, two people who are very much aware of what's going on. And sometimes, and this happened to me with my family, I miss the flags, the red flags that come up. And I had to go back and work with some of my family members and get them going and letting them know that it was something we could get through. Mm-hmm. Did that happen to you?
Yeah, I did. As Lisa was saying, I'm an introvert. Lisa's an extrovert. My daughter's an introvert, and my son's an extrovert. And it affected my son a lot because he was graduating from high school in 2020. He's very smart, highly functional, but he lost the to that tactile connection to people. Plus that, and he was isolated. So not only is he had a delayed entry into college. That was they did that on purpose. So they staggered the freshmen, and so he went to, he was home for a while, and he was kind of fraying a little bit. And I don't want to put his stuff all out there, but then when he got to school, the isolation got to him, like a lot of his classmates, because he was way across on the East Coast. And so, yeah, we went through it. We went through it internally. We went through it as a family. Yeah, I don't know.
And it's very, yes, and it's very hard for a mother who is a counselor, you know, the psychologist, and you're here on the West Coast, your son is on the East Coast, and you can just tell that he is struggling. Mm. So I'm definitely encouraging him. I said, go speak to someone, get some type of help. And at his school, they were overwhelmed because there were so many, this became like a normal thing for everybody. And so what normally you can just, you know, okay, I'll just see the therapist at this college. But now their caseload was so high that they were overwhelmed, and you couldn't get an appointment to see anyone for probably like a month out. Mm. And just like Reggie was saying, that he went through that isolation, because once they got to the school, even though, you know, they let the freshmen come and the freshmen were supposed to be the only people on campus, they still did not have in-person classes. Mm. So you've left your home where you could have been doing your virtual classes at home, because they did give us the option, but we thought, oh no, go have that college experience. He didn't get that college, that freshman college experience like we all would have hoped. Mm-hmm. And so he was isolated there in his dorm room.
Yeah, it was rough. Yeah.
That has to be mentally taxing, especially for an 18-year-old.
Yes, and kids were dropping out like flies. I mean, they got to their dream school, and they were like, no, going, I can't do it. They were dropping back home. They were dropping like flies. Yeah.
Well, as parents, you know, and especially being a trauma surgeon who you have to go, you know, you have to go touch people. How did that affect you mentally? Like, how did you deal? Like, how do you not break down when your kid is struggling, your wife is struggling, you have to go to work, these people still getting shot, you know?
It was, that's a darn good question, let me tell you. At the beginning, it was extremely rough. And I had to maintain, I was scared. Just simple as that, I was scared. But I had to maintain a certain level of calm, because I'm like, well, Lord, you know, if this is gonna take me out, I gotta do my job. So that was the first thing. So I'm like, well, I had to accept the fact that if I get this disease or whatever, if I get COVID and it takes me out, at least I went out doing my job. But I said, I'm gonna take every precaution, because first and foremost, let me protect my family. Let me not bring this home to the kids. Mm-hmm. I don't want to bring it back to the kids. And you're right. In the beginning, you know, I did a podcast from my high school, and I kept saying, everybody's COVID positive until proven otherwise, right? And that's the fear I had. I don't remember the first test tube I put in. I was like, I went and put on a bunny suit. I went and put on everything I could. I had the double barrel respiratory mask.
I heard that.
Man, I was scared as hell. Period. And you know, that was rough. That first year was rough, y'all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know all living it. And so yeah, I was afraid, and there was I come home, I'd go into the garage, like I said in my high school thing, I'd get butt naked, jump in the shower. We have a downstairs bathroom. I jump in the shower, put on some clean clothes, lay on the couch. I think I was laying on the couch for like months, right? I stayed, I didn't get in the bed. I slept downstairs, all of that stuff.
Oh, wow. That's tough.
So, I got to say this. The first operation I did on a COVID positive, well, that's why everybody's talking about it. It's nothing like, so, you know, normally you have on a gown and mask and, you know, goggles, right? It's nothing like putting on a PAPR.
Ooh.
And operating on somebody. I mean.
That's tough.
You like so far removed from the patient. I remember this one patient I was operating on, and I had to fix, as I'm fixing a hole in her lung, there's blood spewing. I have a PAPR on. I'm like, oh Lord, look at all this
Oh, no.
And she was COVID positive.
Oh.
Yeah.
Did you catch it? Did you get COVID?
No.
Good.
Well, it's early on. And here's what I've tried to tell some people. And it affected people differently. But the early on part of it was uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't. And when you don't know, you immediately go to the worst.
Correct.
And you prepare for the worst.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it was hard for me to explain it to people. So I went off and I started doing COVID compliance, and I would explain that on certain productions. I remember a few times I was told to fuck off, but frustrating because I was trying to let them know, we don't know. Everything you're telling me right now that is the opposite of what I'm telling you, it's based on dismissal. You don't know. And that's the reason why people are taking so many precautions.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the most frustrating part about it. Especially those in the medical field who don't know, they're exposed to it more ways than you want to be.
Yes.
Yes.
So mentally and emotionally, it takes a toll. Your wife can't be around you. You can't be with her. You can see each other, but you can't have what people forget, that the sense of touch, the ability to go up to somebody and just grab their finger or whatever it is you do for affection. When that's removed, it does play a role on your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
All of that. That's all of that. I mean, it was just like, wow. I mean, and you know, I went to this zone like, well, I can't ride my bike. I don't want to ride my bike. You know what I mean? And I just not getting back into that. I didn't want to exercise. I started eating bad. I started feeling horrible. I was just like, and I was lucky because guess what? I had a job. You know what I mean? I had a job that I wasn't, quote unquote, in going to lose necessarily. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I was able to leave home. And, you know, Lisa was doing Zoom meetings at home, and my son was at home, and I think my daughter was at home living with us too at the time.
Oh, that's right. She sure was. I forgot about her.
And so, you know, but I was like, well, at least I'm on call tonight. So, I have a great video of that St. Francis where the lady, the housekeeper came down with the bleach gun, and she sprayed down the call room. And I remember after she sprayed it down, my eyes watered for like an hour.
Dang.
I'll send you the video. I took a video of her spraying down the call room with this Lysol, with the Clorox. Get a Clorox gun.
You know,
she killing everything.
Where somebody Lysol sprayed the room so heavily, they gave somebody an asthma attack.
Oh no!
That stuff is harsh.
Yeah,
it was
funny. Just a clock. It was a shut up. Spray gun. One of the spray guns, like the what you call it? The exterminators use. She was a yellow smock, like a yellow raincoat.
Classic.
I have a video. It's great.
So, Dr. Jones, please tell us about this podcast you are doing. I think that's so dope.
Thank you for that. So, I have a podcast coming. I'm putting it all together. I'm writing the first episode. So, it's called Minority Surgeon Confidential. And it's about the history of minority surgeons in L.A., how MLK, the hospital, came about, and some of the struggles. It's not going to be a major political thing. And I'm going to hopefully be able to interview some of my colleagues and people that were important in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I look forward to my podcast. I'm at Minority Surgeon Confidential. And the first kind of run is going to be LA stories. And then we're going to hopefully reach out and talk about other minority surgeons and things like that. And then the medical community in general.
I absolutely can't wait because I know you have a story to tell and a lot of knowledge to give, all of you.
Appreciate that.
So before we let them go, Bethany, I just want to bring something up. Something that I'll never forget about you, Reggie, is that you knew what my interests were and you were more than willing to participate in helping me move along with what I wanted to do. So right now on the podcast, I want to say thank you. that is the fact that you are a real fan, and you impressed me that you knew more about the industry and the history of what I love than I did. Man, this man made me read just because of it. I'd say something like, "Oh man, I got to tell you about this movie."
Well, thank you. Thank you,
brother. Any movie. I'll bring up anything that I think he hasn't seen. I don't remember what I brought up. One sec, now, man. Let me tell you how it went down. On the inside, I'd be a bit envious and a bit angry, but I wouldn't show it.
Yeah, he make you feel some kind of way.
But that's the thing about Reggie. Reggie is a man of many, what's the word, dimensions? No, that's the wrong word.
Many dimensions.
He is multi-talented. He's not just a surgeon. He has many hobbies, many interests. I try to educate him on jazz, and he gave me an education.
Oh, please don't try to go there with this man. Dr. Pryor, too. Dr. Pryor would put his music on, honey, and it was on like popcorn.
Well, you know, we love, listen, that you guys were the rewards, and it was rewarding working in St. Francis with both of you and everybody, and that's what I miss a lot. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we are winding down, but just before we go, one last question. If you had one wish to change healthcare or to, you know, see some sort of different future for healthcare, what would it be?
To put it back in the hands of physicians, I think physician administrators and things like that, and try to make it, and this is a far off goal, but make it less of a business and more. We know we try to make it patient centered, but maybe doctor friendly again. I feel like it's moving away from being doctor friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we're fighting against the tide. We're like little Don Quixotes now. And but well, I don't know. You know, that's what that'd be my wish. Hey, my wife wants to say something.
Yeah, and for me, which is something that I've always wanted to happen, is I think that there needs to be more mental health opportunities for doctors, nurses,
anyone in the
medical field. Because, you know, you guys have a lot on your plate, and you have a lot that you have to deal with. And I think that, you know, just having some type of wellness center or something where you guys have something. I mean, we're always talking about the patient, but what about the doctor?
Yes.
What about the nurse? What about those, especially in this time of the pandemic? What happens with them? They don't have anyone to be able to talk to about all these things. You know, there's been a lot of death. There's been a lot of tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And to have something for you guys to, you know, to be able to talk somewhere.
I agree 100%. It would be a lot of times, Dr. Jones, where I would actually see you like walking to and from the cafeteria or something. And it would be like maybe 5 or 6 in the morning. But I know that either you had slept all night or you were busy all night. But I still would just give you that respect to leave you alone, because sometimes you just don't want to be bothered mentally. You're just exhausted and you don't want to be bothered.
It's all good. You would have never bothered me. It's all good. But that was my wife's plug. So when she hangs, you're going to hang her shingle for post-traumatic stress in the physician and healthcare.
You need to open up her business, her wellness business. Come on, Daddy Warbucks. Hook it up. Well, thanks again, guys, for coming on the show. Dr. Jones, what's the name of that podcast again?
Minority Surgeon Confidential.
All right. We are going to be looking out for that. Awesome conversation. I appreciate everything that you've done for the community, that you continue to do for the community, both of you. Dr. Lisa, for the children, thank you so much. And it was great talking to you guys.
I can't thank you guys enough for coming on. Lisa, Reggie, it was great to catch up on the podcast. I do want a part 2.
I agree.
I want it to be a bit lighter. We can hear Reggie go ahead and quote one of his movies.
All right. It was our pleasure, those guys.
All right. All right, everybody. That is the end of episode 6. We will see you on the next episode. In the meantime, keep your ass out the emergency room. Bye. You know, man.